Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Calls Media Roundtable. Abortion rights activists and average citizens who believe in bodily autonomy and a woman's right to choose whether and when to have a child took to the streets across the country this week to speak out against abortion bans and the ongoing Republican attacks on abortion. Joining us to discuss coverage of these bans are three guests. Dr. Katie Woodruff is a public health social scientist at UC San Francisco. She has been studying newspaper coverage since 2016, and she finds that abortion is covered superficially as a political hot-button issue, not as a health issue or even a, quote, women's issue. Hi, Dr. Woodruff. Welcome to the show. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning. We're also joined by Jessica Glenza, a senior health reporter at The Guardian, where she has covered anti-abortion policies in the past couple of years. Previously, Jessica was part of a reporting team that revealed 33 U.S. cities used outdated methods to test water for lead. Jessica's recent piece in The Guardian is called "The Anti-Gay Extremist Behind America's Fiercely Strict Abortion Bans," and she is writing about Janet Porter, and we'll learn more about her later in the show. Hi, Jessica. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks so much for having me.
Nice to have you. We're also joined by Jennifer Gerson. We have a Jessica and a Jennifer today. Jennifer Gerson is an Atlanta-based writer and reporter whose work has appeared in several publications, including Teen Vogue, Yahoo, The Guardian, and Mike. She is a 2015 Maggie Award recipient for her reporting on topics surrounding reproductive health and reproductive justice. And Jennifer has a piece in NBC called "Georgia and Ohio's New Abortion Laws Will Harm Women, But Republicans Only Care About Winning a Political Battle." Hi, Jennifer. Thank you for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Well, it's great to have all of you. Thank you so much for your work. Dr. Woodruff, I want to start off with you because you have been extensively researching abortion coverage in newspapers since 2016. And for this show, you also looked at how the papers have been covering these recent bans. So what really stands out for you? I think this is really important, that abortion is covered superficially as a political hot-button issue, but not as a health issue.
Most of the news coverage that we see of abortion is very much in a political context where abortion is almost used as a as a stand-in to just illustrate how divisive our American political culture has become. You often see it mentioned along with gun control or other very divisive issues. But even when it is covered substantively, we're not seeing a lot of coverage that would help people understand the context of abortion as a safe and common health care service. So we don't hear stories of people who needed abortion very often, and we see many more references to the fetus as a person than to women's own personal stories of grappling with unintended pregnancy and choosing abortion. So in our sample of newspaper coverage, only 4% included an actual personal abortion story, even a reference to someone's abortion story. So women continue to be sort of invisible in mainstream news coverage of this issue.
And can you tell us what newspapers, the New York Times, Washington Post, all the big ones?
Yeah, so this study looked specifically at the New York Times, the Washington Post, and the Associated Press as a wire service, because these are the newspapers that set the agenda for so many other media outlets. And so it's not by any means comprehensive to all newspaper coverage in the paper, but it is sort of the leading political and the highest readership newspapers in the country.
And Jessica, what would you add? The other thing that really struck me over the last week is that it seems like so much of the attention on this issue is shifting to Washington, D.C. and how abortion is going to play out in the 2020 election.
Yeah, I think that exactly what Katie is saying is right, which is we cover it so much as a political issue, and it's so often not heard of as a healthcare issue for women. And you're right, a lot of it is shifting to the 2020 race. I don't think that's entirely uncalled for in some ways, though, because what we might start to see is more discussion about how the left could legislate abortion rights as opposed to what's taken place over the last couple decades, the right legislating to make obtaining an abortion more and more onerous. So it's a mixed picture from my perspective.
Jennifer, what are your thoughts?
Yes, I mean, I think that certainly what Katie was saying is true, and I think it's something that, and I'm sure Jess would feel the same, that reporters talk about with editors a lot, too. I think there is a conversation to be had about the way we talk about this and who the folks are on the ground, in addition, who are impacted by these kinds of laws, and not just the, you know, legislators and the agendas kind of pushing them, and how that speaks to the tenor of American politics right now. Though it's, I think, also important not to lose the narrative on what the kind of big picture of legislative goals are, too, because these things aren't happening in a vacuum. And the reason we're seeing such a kind of uptick right now is this has been a long game strategy, and the kind of time feels right, I think, for a lot of right-wing lawmakers. You know, certainly in state legislatures, they know they have a empathetic administration. They believe they have a Supreme Court that is going to rule in a way they like. And the end game is to see, you know, Roe overturned. So this has been a long-standing strategic initiative. And so it's a tricky thing to cover in that sense, because you don't want to just make this about politics as usual, because people's lives are literally at stake. The data certainly speaks to that fact, but this is also, I think it's very important to make sure people understand that this is part of a strategic initiative that's been in place for quite a number of years to see, you know, abortion not just made difficult to access, but completely inaccessible and illegal in the United States, no matter where you live.
Right. And as we've reported for many, many years, and as you all have focused on in so many parts of the country, I mean, even here in California, it is incredibly difficult for poor women, women of color, to get access to abortion. So, Dr. Woodruff, what are your thoughts about that? I mean, when we got the ban, near total ban, in Alabama, the coverage exploded. And people in Alabama who work on the ground said they were really angry because they felt like the New York Times, for example, did not accurately report, or at least include in the report, that abortion is still legal in Alabama today, and it will be for at least 6 months. We just heard that Planned Parenthood just filed their lawsuit. And so various groups on the ground were inundated with phone calls from women asking, can I still come in? Is abortion still legal? So even just basic information to give people is missing from pieces. In fact, the Columbia Journalism Review pointed that out in one of their pieces.
Yeah, it's there's a lot of confusion that comes in the wake of any of this kind of legislation about what the actual availability is. And it adds to the overall perception of abortion as dangerous and hard to get and not very common. And in fact, in our study, we found that basic facts about abortion rarely are included in any of the news coverage. So the fact that abortion is very safe in America, it is 14 times safer to have an abortion than to continue the pregnancy to term and give birth. But that is not showing up in any, rarely in news coverage. It's very common in abortion. One in four women in the United States now will have an abortion in her lifetime. And most abortions happen in the first trimester. 9 out of 10 abortions are happening in the first trimester. Very, very few are these very late abortions that Trump has been wanting to make a lot turning a lot of attention to. And yet those facts are definitely not included in news coverage. And so all the facts that would help people understand that abortion is still available, that it is safe, that it's a common health care service that most people who get early on, all of that is missing from the news coverage. And it's just reinforcing these inaccurate perceptions that abortion is unsafe and that it largely occurs in tragic circumstances.
You also point out one other fact that is missing, and that is most people who get abortions are already mothers. 61% have children already.
Yeah, I think that's rarely included, and it's so surprising. Even people who, work in reproductive health may not realize that. And when you tell people that or really emphasize it, you can get an understanding that people are just trying to make the best decisions for the family that they already have and the circumstances that they find themselves in. And I think it helps paint the picture of who is getting abortions in a much more sympathetic light, but that fact is also not included in most news coverage.
That is Dr. Katie Woodruff, public health social scientist at UC San Francisco, and she's been studying newspaper coverage of abortion since 2016. She finds that it is covered superficially as a political hot-button issue, not as a health issue. We're also joined by Jennifer Gerson, an Atlanta-based writer and reporter whose work appears in many publications, including Teen Vogue and The Guardian. Jessica Glenza is senior health reporter at The Guardian, where she has covered anti-abortion policies in the past several years. And if you have any questions or comments for our guests, this issue is getting a lot of attention. What are your thoughts about how it is being covered? What really stands out for you about, well, the questions that, for example, reporters are asking these presidential candidates, the framing of this issue, the guest choice of this issue? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255. I was struck last week, I think it was, Chuck Todd from Meet the Press had on two white men to talk about this. It was Bernie Sanders and Tom Cotton, and the framing was actually really shocking. Did any of you see that interview? I heard someone laugh. Was that Jennifer or Jessica?
I'm sorry, that was me. I was not able to see the interview, but I did chuckle when you said it was two white men invited on to speak to another white man about abortion.
Yeah, and
what else is new?
Well, right, and I think the framing, though, was really dangerous because Tom Cotton said things about, you know, late-term abortions and babies being born when they're aborted, and, I mean, there was no shock on Chuck Todd's face, no pushback. And I don't really like to spend that much time talking about this because it's just so out there and so extreme, but Dr. Woodruff, this is now seeping into the mainstream.
If you're talking about Trump has made these claims repeatedly since January that doctors are performing infanticide, that somehow babies are being born babies are being killed after they're born alive. It's just so absurd that you don't want to dignify it with a response. This does not happen. But I believe that it has become really powerful for the Republicans. It's really riling up their base. And I think that may have contributed to the climate that let the states know that they could go ahead and try these really extreme bans because they have a president who is willing to go extreme on this issue. It's absolutely not accurate. That does not happen in abortion practice.
Was that Jessica?
Yeah, hi. Can I respond? I just want to add to Katie's point, which is about the tenor of conversation, especially that coming from the president, has really shifted the entire debate to a level that was, before his election, considered fringe. Mm. And that a lot of the people that are now leading these bans on abortion across the United States were people that were not supported by establishment anti-abortion groups prior to Donald Trump's election. So I just wanted to put that out there because it's as if the entire window for acceptable debate has shifted. And the idea that Chuck Todd could call out a man who described late-term abortion as medically inaccurate,
right,
is striking. The term late-term, if you're a physician, refers to a time post 40 weeks in a pregnancy. A pregnancy full term is 40 weeks. Late-term is considered after 40 weeks. So the idea that there's a late-term abortion is inaccurate to the point that it doesn't exist. The fact that a term that's gained mainstream acceptance is something that should be striking and shocking to people.
Jennifer?
Oh, yes. I would just add actually two things. I think first, like Jessica and Katie have said, it's getting to the point of absurdity that these questions are being asked because there's no basis in reality behind these claims. So when you're even asking it, we should ask next, if the moon is made of cheese, it's the same, kind of question. But I think it's interesting, too, and there probably should be greater pushback from the press largely, too, and how candidates are answering these things. I mean, we even saw from Bernie Sanders, who just mentioned during his, town hall with Fox News, when he was asked about these, late-term abortions, he said, well, it's very rare. But his answer wasn't, well, this is absurd. This never happens. This isn't a medically accurate description of something, but that this is something rare, and we need to understand that. So I think there needs to be kind of pushback across the political spectrum the candidates and how they are choosing to respond to this and thus choosing to perpetuate some of this, just the complete inaccuracies that are part of the narrative now. I think that is really important.
Jessica?
I would say, just to go back to the Sanders issue, there is a lot of criticism that can be lobbed at Bernie Sanders on this issue, but I do think that immediately after the abortion ban, he had one of the best tweets on the issue, which was, abortion is a constitutional right. And you saw a lot of people in the 2020 field coming out with these statements about why this is not fair, it's not fair to women, women should have bodily autonomy, but very few people put out that simple statement, which is something we talked about earlier, abortion is a constitutional right. It is legal in the United States, in all 50 states.
Right.
I think all this also speaks to something else that's a real problem with what these bills and when they get signed, what these laws do, and especially when they're based in such inaccuracies, is they just perpetuate such an intense sense of stigma and shame. And, you know, like you mentioned, you know, women are calling or not sure if abortion is still legal where they live, even though, you know, like in places like Alabama, you can still get an abortion today. When the language is so shameful that is being used about this, the idea that women are sitting holding their baby after giving birth and trying to decide whether they should have it killed by a doctor. You know, I mean, that the idea of who people are that are seeking a very safe form of, you know, time-tested, safe medical care, and that there is this intense moral judgment being associated with this because of the escalation of the rhetoric. You know, that's problematic too, and it makes things worse. It's like the end game isn't just to end abortion, but to make people who have sought out and continue to seek out abortion care feel bad about themselves and the choices they've made for themselves and their families.
Right. Well, and that's why so many people are sharing their personal stories on social media. And we'll talk about that in a minute, but let's take a call. Let's hear from Kina in Albany. Hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for taking my call. It's actually Kenna.
Oh, hi, Kenna. Sorry.
No worries. I just wanted to say that I feel as though women of color are really being invisibilized in the coverage, in addition to the fact that it's not just a women's issue, it's also a trans person's issue. And finally, the fact that even here in California, we actually don't have as much access as people think. There's only 3 centers in the entire state where you can get an abortion if you are at high medical risk. And so while we're focusing on Alabama and all these other bans, we're really also not continuing the coverage around what we still need to do here.
Right. Well, you brought up a number of things there, and that is a very good point. Youth Radio actually did an amazing piece about how hard it is for college students in California to access abortion. And you know, we've covered stories about restrictions here in California. What about that, Dr. Woodruff? When you look at the stories of women in the media, who does get the microphone? What about people of color and trans people?
Yeah, it's the caller's absolutely right. It's very rare to see coverage of stories of women of color. It's rare to have included in the news coverage the fact that the majority of patients who seek abortion are women of color, that women of color are disproportionately represented among abortion patients, all for complicated reasons having to do with racism and access to health care and variety of issues, and that women who are low income are disproportionately represented among abortion, another group. And those of us in reproductive health, especially who have been in it for a long time, do tend to use the word woman a lot when we're talking about these issues, but this absolutely applies to any person who has a uterus and has the opportunity or the potential to get pregnant. It's very much a trans person's issue as well, and we need to be better at talking about that, and we need to get more news coverage of that as well.
And what would you add on that question, Jennifer?
No, I mean, I think that's something that's certainly true. And I find that, though, certainly the folks who work on these issues are acutely aware of it. And I certainly feel, as a reporter, it's something you hear a lot from the folks who do work on these issues, people in the reproductive health community and people in the reproductive justice community, I don't think you can get through an interview without someone reminding you that this is, first of all, who this disproportionately impacts, which is low-income women and women of color and young people, and that we need to be very conscientious of using gender-inclusive language when we talk about this, because though, you know, as you mentioned at the top of the show, it's, you know, certainly a quote-unquote women's issue, it's not exclusively a women's issue. And so this is an issue about pregnant people, and it's really about anyone, you know, who's not a cisgender heterosexual man. I think that a lot of these laws speak to the fact that the lives of people who don't meet that description are really, you know, hanging in the balance right now with this administration and the kind of permissiveness it's given to people on the, like you mentioned previously, kind of fringe elements of the Republican Party to grab the mic and grab the legislative agenda. And that is definitely worthy of attention, too. That, you know, lives of a whole lot of people who just aren't white men are at play here. And that needs to be discussed as we talk about all of this.
And Jessica, what would you add?
Well, I would just say that this is something that we take into account in our coverage every single day, which is, do you call it reproductive rights versus women's rights? And reproductive rights is the way that we go. But I just kind of wanted to say one of the more inspiring things that I've seen in my own reporting is the formation of Black Women's Health Caucuses. Mm. These are new this year, and you're seeing it in response to the disproportionately high rate of maternal mortality for Black women. And I really can't think of stronger or more inspiring advocates than the Black female legislators who are forming these caucuses across the country. And a couple of people that I talked to in Ohio, a couple of the legislators who formed one of these, they're just incredible advocates for their constituents and sort of trying to counteract a lot of what we're talking about right now, which is that you don't hear these voices. One of the things that really struck me in an interview I did with one of these legislators was she said to me, you know, it's so wild to see so many men voting in favor of these bans because they act as if they're trying to come save my people. And she said to me, you know, my people don't need saving. Mm-hmm. And so it was just really amazing to hear her talk about this as like an issue that was not in the top 10 for her constituents because they're worried about housing security and jobs and a living wage. But for her, it was an issue of, well, what's justice? What's right? And so it was really incredible to speak to someone like that. And I think it's a bright spot in the discussion that we're having today that there is this organization happening on the left around where do we go next?
That is just.
I would add.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay, I would add to that, you know, as part of that as well, that when we talk about the kinds of bills that are being passed and where they're being passed right now, especially, that these are places that typically have disproportionately high maternal mortality rates mm-hmm. and infant mortality rates, and even, you know, more so disproportionately for women of color. You know, you look at Georgia where we just saw the 6-week ban signed, and this is the worst state in the country for maternal mortality and a place where Black women are 4 times more likely to die in childbirth than women of any other race. So I think, again, you've got Ohio where infant mortality is at an all-time high, and they're also trying to defund Planned Parenthood and eliminate the, you know, program Planned Parenthood runs in the state that helps prevent infant mortality for Black women and Black children especially. So I think when you, it's always important to kind of, especially as a journalist, try to force the step back in the contextualization of the fact that these laws aren't happening in a vacuum and the holistic picture of who's being impacted and what else is happening in that state and in regards to these people's lives and how care for their lives is or is not of concern.
And Dr. Woodruff, we have to take a quick break, but we'll get your response in just a minute. That is Jennifer Gerson, an Atlanta-based writer and reporter whose work has appeared in many publications, including Teen Vogue and Mike. And Jessica Glenza is a senior health reporter at The Guardian, where she covers abortion policies. And Dr. Katie Woodruff is public health social scientist at UC San Francisco, where she has done extensive research on newspaper coverage of abortion since 2016. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we are discussing media coverage of abortion bans passing across the country. We're joined by Dr. Katie Woodruff, public health social scientist at UC San Francisco. She extensively researches newspaper coverage of abortion. Jennifer Gerson is an Atlanta-based writer and reporter whose work has appeared in many publications, including Teen Vogue. And Jennifer wrote a piece for NBC called Georgia and Ohio's New Abortion Laws Will Harm Women, but Republicans Only Care About Winning a Political Battle. Jessica Glenza is a senior health reporter at The Guardian, and one of her latest pieces is about Janet Porter, and it's called The Anti-Gay Extremist Behind America's Fiercely Strict Abortion Bans. And we're going to talk about your piece in a minute, but I know, Dr. Woodruff, you wanted to jump in, and I just wanted to add that we had Alabama State Senator Linda Coleman Madison, one of just four women in the state Senate in Alabama. She is African American. We were talking about the fact that Alabama's children struggle with hunger. More than a quarter of the children live in poverty. This includes obviously many, many young people of color. And she put forward a bill that basically said, if you pass this ban, we, the state, is going to provide prenatal and postnatal services. We're going to ensure that the mother gets what she needs, mental and psychological treatment. You know, we're going to support and nurture the mother and the child. And she said, of course, the Republicans voted against this. Unanimously, they voted against it. She said the hypocrisy of all of this is just blatant. Dr.
Well, Woodruff? I just wanted to say I'm grateful that Jessica and Jennifer brought up the maternal mortality crisis, because it's missing from the debate about abortion. And news coverage talks about abortion in a vacuum, as if there were some other alternative to pregnancy that's safer. But we forget that childbirth itself is dangerous, and it's inherently dangerous. It always has been, and it continues to be. And we're seeing that the people who are most affected by that are women of color across the country. So in this context, restricting abortion further is going to literally kill more women. And I'm not saying that out of hyperbole. It is true. And they're not going to die as we did pre-Roe. We saw a lot of people dying from botched back alley abortions. But women are going to die from not being able to get the abortion they want and having to go through childbirth with all of the risks that that entails when that is not a choice and a decision that they want for their lives. So in this context, abortion really can save lives. And I am really not seeing this connection being discussed much in the news, at least in mainstream news at all, that abortion really is a maternal health issue.
Mm. And what about the other issues about in these states where they've got incredibly high poverty rates, hunger rates, education crises? You know, a number of the politicians who vote against these bans say, you vote for these bans and call yourself pro-life. Look at the state of our children in this, you know, when you look at poverty and healthcare, for example. What about those connections?
There was a study that done just a couple of years ago that found that the states that had the most restrictive abortion bans also had the least sort of family-friendly or supportive bills and laws and policies to help support families in all the ways that they need to take care of children. And this is why abortion is connected to a broader reproductive justice issue, that for people it's not just about whether they choose to continue a pregnancy and have a child or not, but do they have the resources and supports that they need to raise a child in safety and healthily.
Jennifer, you're in Georgia, and you've been writing about Brian Kemp signing a law making abortion illegal after a fetal heartbeat can be detected, or roughly 6 weeks after conception. We have similar bills in Ohio, Mississippi, and Kentucky. Are people making these connections, as you did, when we're talking about maternal mortality, but then also just the high rates of poverty and hunger and other social issues?
I mean, again, I think in the reproductive justice community, it's, you know, the people doing this work every day know that these issues are inherently connected and one and the same. But I do think people forget, and I know I just, you know, anecdotally heard from speaking with folks that people don't necessarily know to make that connection. They don't know that Georgia is the worst place in the country for maternal mortality, that black women are disproportionately dying in childbirth in this state, that one in four children live in a food insecure household in this state. And it's interesting, too, when you think that, I think it was just days after Kemp signed the six-week ban bill into law, that he also vetoed a bill that would make recess mandatory in public schools, because he said he didn't want to take sovereignty away from school administrators. So, you know, it's like it's just hard to look at these things in a vacuum, but I think that especially right now, there's just, it feels like the hits just keep on coming. I think there's so much in the news right now, and with the amount of just the volume of coverage around some of these bans, I think it's hard for people to step back and take the time to dig into what's going on in any one of the places where these things are happening, and kind of look at the big picture, too, of what this means for people who live in the state. You know, Georgia, too, the rural health situation is grim at best. Mm-hmm. So I do think, you know, just the average person on the ground does forget these things, but for no fault of their own, I think there's a lot of information to consume and digest and have the dots connected. And I do think it's the job of the media as much as possible to help people get that context and connect those dots.
And Jessica, earlier in the show, you were just talking about how the conversation has shifted even more to the right. And you write about this woman, Janet Porter, who successfully lobbied Ohio's legislature to pass one of the strictest bans in the world, the heartbeat bill, which would make the procedure illegal at about 6 weeks into pregnancy. You write that this is a woman who believes life begins at conception. I mean, she said some horrific things that I would rather not repeat about gay, LGBT people. You say that at one point she had a lot of enemies on the right, but in Trump's America, she's been victorious. So how did this person who was considered fringe, even by Republicans, end up with such a microphone?
Well, I would just say that I don't feel that she's entered the mainstream, or that the people who were her opponents in the past are now on her side. She was not invited to the bill signing of the six-week abortion ban in Ohio, and I think that tells you a lot about how divisive her lobbying tactics are to many people. And this is something that she would tell you herself. I don't think this is in dispute. She came more into the public conversation after lobbying for this bill for 10 years because there was a shift to the right in Ohio because of gerrymandering that allowed more and more extreme candidates to come onto the legislature, and for a governor who campaigned on this issue to eventually get this bill that she for 10 years lobbied for to finally pass and be signed by a governor in Ohio. And so I think that you have two dynamics going on. You have
one going on in the state of Ohio regarding their gerrymandering, and then you have another dynamic happening at the federal level on the U.S. Supreme Court with the confirmation of U.S. Justice Brett Kavanaugh. And I just want to refresh people's memory in the case that they have not been following this as closely as we as reporters have. U.S. Justice Anthony Kennedy was considered a swing vote on abortion. So you had a 9-member court, 4 conservative, 4 liberal, and 1 swing vote. And when U.S. Justice Brett Kavanaugh was confirmed, that really rebalanced the court and put it so it was right-leaning, it's conservative-leaning. So you have 5 conservative justices and 4 liberal now. And so you had these two dynamics taking place in Ohio that energized people around this bill and really gave it a platform. And so I don't think it's as if Janet Porter became more mainstream or her opponents came to see her view. It's that the institutions were set up in such a way to allow this kind of extreme legislation to become more and more likely to pass. And the window for acceptable debate in the United States shifted to the right with rhetoric like Donald Trump's.
Well, this is an important point, and we're going to invite Dave Daly on in a couple of weeks because he wrote a piece called How Gerrymandering Leads to Radical Abortion Laws. He writes, Georgia's fetal heartbeat bill never would have passed if the state legislature truly reflected the voters' political preferences. What are your thoughts on that, Jennifer?
Well, I mean, that I think that, you know, very true. In such a way, coming off the gubernatorial election we just had here and what we saw in terms of, I think, what is pretty widely recognized as voter disenfranchisement leading up to the, you know, race, the election between Stacey Abrams and Brian Kemp. So I think when you certainly have gerrymandering like this and when people are being pretty grossly disenfranchised, and the people who are being disenfranchised are the folks who are disproportionately impacted by these bills. I mean, it's just a perfect storm. So this is certainly happening.
I mean, the thing about gerrymandering is that it is a practice which effectively makes the general election meaningless. This is from a political scientist in Ohio I spoke with. So it makes it so that the primary election, where you're more likely to see an extreme and a very committed base come out, becomes the competitive election. And so you have this situation where, of course, you're going to get more extreme candidates. And the same political scientist in Ohio, and I found this really striking, told me that he unequivocally believed that gerrymandering led to this extreme abortion ban in Ohio, which I think most people think of as a purple state in presidential elections.
Well, unfortunately, we are out of time, but we would love to have you all back to continue this important discussion. I should also mention that according to Data for Progress, there is no state in the country where support for banning abortion reaches even 25%. Jessica Glenza is senior health reporter at The Guardian. Jennifer Gerson is an Atlanta-based writer and reporter whose work has appeared in Teen Vogue and The Guardian. And Dr. Katie Woodruff is a public health social scientist at UC San Francisco, where she researches newspaper coverage of abortion. Dr. Woodruff, Jennifer, and Jessica, thank you so much for your work. Thank you for joining us, and we'd love to have you back.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you. This is Your Calls Media Roundtable. I'm Rose Aguilar, and now we are going to talk about press freedom. On Friday, May 10th, San Francisco police officers used a sledgehammer to bash in the front door of the home of journalist Brian Carmody, who was investigating the death of San Francisco public defender Jeff Adachi. Journalists across the country are condemning the raid, saying it is a serious infringement on press freedom. Joining us to talk about this is Tim Redmond, founder and journalist at 48 Hills, an online publication that offers breaking news and investigative reporting of San Francisco. Tim Redmond is former editor and publisher of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Hi, Tim. Thank you for joining us.
Hi, Rose. So happy to be on the show.
It's great to have you. So Tim, for people who have not been following this, because we also air outside of the Bay Area, can you just give us a little bit of background here? I guess start with, you know, who is journalist Brian Carmody?
Brian Carmody is what's known in the industry as a stringer for various TV stations. What he basically does is he works the late night shift. He works overnight with TV cameras going around and getting footage of crimes, accidents, anything else that, while most of the TV station employees are not working, he's out there in the middle of the night getting video footage and interviews, and then he sells it as a freelancer to TV stations. This is a fairly common practice in the TV industry. There's a lot of people who do this. And he managed to get, after our public defender, widely respected, much loved public defender Jeff Adachi, died, the police came and investigated the place where he died, even though the paramedics who arrived said there's no need for a police investigation, there was no foul play, he, you know, apparently had a heart attack. The police arrived anyway and did a report with some salacious stuff in it that got leaked to Carmody, who then sold it to various TV stations. Now, I'll say from the start, I don't think this was news. I don't think any of the TV stations should have aired it. I think just in terms of journalistic ethics, it was horrible. Nevertheless, he's a reporter who went and got confidential information and sold it to TV stations that published it, right? He the police then burst into his house, handcuffed him for 6 hours, and took everything, computers, hard drives, cameras, everything, as opposed to trying to find out exactly who leaked him the information. I mean, the cops consider it certainly inappropriate and a firing offense to leak a confidential police report. The cop who did it, the police officer who leaked this, is and should be in serious trouble. So they thought, well, if we take everything, we take his phones, we take his notepads, we take, maybe we'll find out who that officer was. Right? Now, the problem is, first of all, he's a journalist, and he's protected by the Shield Law in California. Second, they didn't just ask for text messages from a phone that would have revealed contacts with a certain police officer. They took everything, all kinds of stuff that may have all kinds of confidential information about other sources and other stories and other stuff we don't want the cops to see. So this was a dangerous thing, number one. Number two, the police are now saying, under tremendous fire, that nationwide, this is an embarrassment for San Francisco, and nationwide, the free press organizations, journalists, newspapers are coming down and saying the San Francisco police should never have done this. And under this fire, to defend themselves, the chief just announced May 21st that they are looking into whether Brian Carmody is a criminal suspect, that he may have conspired criminally to get this information. Now, that's unprecedented. I can't remember in my 35-plus years doing this ever seeing a journalist who released confidential information being charged criminally for doing it. It's really, really scary, because a lot of us investigative reporters on a regular basis get information from confidential sources that the government doesn't want released, and we put it out. That's one of the things that investigative reporters do, and it's how some horrible scandals in government over many, many, many years, going back to, you know, the Pentagon Papers, have come out. The idea that a journalist who is doing what his job is, while I disagree with his decision to publish this, I disagree with the TV station's decision to publish this, nevertheless, he was doing his job, can be criminally investigated, is scary. And it dovetails with what's going on the national level, when Donald Trump wants to charge Julian Assange with criminal espionage violations. This has never happened. The Espionage Act is a World War I era law. We have never had a journalist charged with violating the Espionage Act for publishing sensitive information. All right. Again, there are a lot of ways in which I'm not a fan of Julian Assange. He's done a lot of things that I don't think he should have done. Nevertheless, that's not the issue. They're charging a journalist under the Espionage Act with a criminal activity for publishing sensitive information. And that's these two on the national level, on the local level. It's very, very scary. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think about all the times I and other people I know have gotten confidential information from government whistleblowers who are able to give us information that exposes official corruption only on the grounds that we never reveal where it came from, because that person could lose his or her job. This is going to scare whistleblowers from coming forward, and it's going to frighten journalists about the, you know, gee, if I publish this information, could I go to jail? It's a really, really scary precedent on both levels.
Right. And just since you brought up Assange, his lawyer was on Democracy Now! This morning, Jennifer Robinson, and she said, let's remember that Julian Assange is not an American. Everything he did was outside of the United States. So this is concerning for every journalist and publisher anywhere. She said if an American journalist is in China, for example, and publishes secrets that they got from someone, the Chinese government could go after them now. And so the Trump...
Absolutely. Citing this precedent, saying, right. Hey, the United States is doing it.
Right. Tim, two basic questions about the case in San Francisco. So we know that a police officer leaked this information to Brian Carmody?
It had to be because no one else except the SFPD had access to that report.
Okay, so then if that is the case, we're supposed to assume that SFPD could not figure out amongst themselves who leaked this? They had to take a sledgehammer and knock down the door of this journalist to find out who leaked it?
Well, you know, my question was, there's a limited number of officers who had access to that report, right? The police chief knows everyone who was on duty that night. They know everyone who went to the apartment. They know everyone who made the report and everyone who had access to it. That's a limited universe, all right? Have all of those officers had their cell phones seized and searched? Has someone gone to all of their houses and taken their hard drives and their computers? You would think that SFPD would be able to figure this out without internally. And they should. They should investigate this. This should not, information should not have been leaked. And I completely agree that the officer who did it should face disciplinary consequences up to and possibly termination under the rules of the SFPD, because that person shouldn't have done it. Nevertheless, you'd think they could figure that out without having to go after a journalist with a sweeping, Carmody's lawyer said, a breathtakingly broad search warrant that allowed them to take everything in his house.
We have a question on social media from Wendy, and she says, what I don't understand about this raid is why the focus is not on the leak. And so the real leaker was someone in the police department, which had its reasons for disliking Jeff Adachi. Why is the focus on the journalist and not the leaker?
Well, that's the big question. Why is the focus on the journalist? And, you know, I'm not a lawyer, but I have always been told that if you subpoena a reporter and try to get them to give up confidential, unpublished information, the only time judges are ever supposed to allow that is if it's absolutely essential, for example, in a murder case, and there's no other way to get that information. In this case, of course there's no other way to get that information. So somebody in SFPD leaked this information. Somebody in SFPD probably, we don't know their motives, but the SFPD officers, many of them did not like the public defender because he tried to hold the police accountable. Somebody, in an effort to smear the name of the public defender, leaked a confidential police report. And as I say, the universe of officers who could have done that is relatively small.
So SFPD got a search warrant to enter his home, and the judge who approved it apparently knew that Brian Carmody was a journalist?
That is what we're hearing now. Yeah, there are actually two different judges that signed off on search warrants. And we are told, although, of course, to make the case even more interesting, normally when a police officer gets a search warrant, they basically fill out an application. They put out an affidavit and they give it to the judge. And they say, this is what the case is about, and this is why we need to search this particular place and seize these particular things, which is required under the Constitution. Right? Normally, after the search warrant is issued, that application becomes public record. And we can look at it and say, hey, what did the judge know? Well, that has been sealed. The judges have not released that, and we don't know why. The California First Amendment Coalition has filed court briefs asking that that document be released. And it will be eventually. When it is, we will see. Did they say, we're searching the home of Brian Carmody, a journalist, for these reasons? And given that information, did these judges still sign off on it, which would be shocking.
San Francisco Mayor London Breed said police, quote, went through the appropriate legal process to request a search warrant, which was approved by two judges, end quote. Then more than a week later, after the story really exploded and the media condemned it, Mayor Breed backtracked a bit, saying, although she wanted a thorough investigation into the leak, quote, I am not okay with police raids on reporters. We need to do better, end quote. So do we know, Tim, was the SFPD in contact with any government official when it decided to do this raid?
Well, we don't know for sure, but we have to, I mean, let's talk about political reality here. If, in fact, they knew they were breaking into the home of the journalist, that they were doing this, it seems highly unlikely to me that one newly minted sergeant who oversaw this investigation and this raid would have done it on his own. All right? This went up the chain of command. I would be very surprised if the chief of police didn't know that this was going to happen. And being as the chief of police reports to the mayor, I don't know. I would, again, I don't know for sure, but given the way things typically work in the city, I would be very surprised if someone hadn't alerted the mayor's office in advance that this was going to happen. I would be very surprised. They might not have. She might not have known anything about it, but that would be unusual given the way things work in the city.
It's also been interesting to see how the supervisors, even the progressive supervisors, did not have much to say in the beginning. What are they saying now?
Well, most people have come around now and said that this was a terrible thing, that the police should never have done this. I think what happened was, when it first happened, I mean, after this information was leaked and came out, in an attempt to smear the good name of Jeff Adachi, like just days after he had died, the supervisors held a hearing and called in the police chief and said, how did you let this happen? How could this happen? How could this confidential information be leaked out of your department in the name of smearing the good name of the public defender? And the chief said, oh, we're going to find out who did it. We're going to have an investigation. And I think people were so upset that this information came out that when they filed a search warrant and searched the journalist's house, I fear that a few people may have thought, oh, well, good, we're going to get to the bottom of this. But while I agree there should be an investigation, and I agree the information should never have been leaked, and I've gone even further, I have said the TV stations, it was horrible. It was like clickbait National Enquirer style stuff to even run this material. It should never have been published.
And I have to say, I feel for Jeff Adachi's wife, Tim, because I heard one clip of her on an NPR piece, and she was crying, saying this has been horrific for her and her daughter.
It's horrible.
Right.
It's horrible. He's got a wife and daughter. This is terrible, right? It should never have happened. That doesn't excuse the police breaking into a journalist's house and seizing all of this stuff. Mm. All right, so we have to separate those two issues. And I feel very, very strongly that this was the leak was awful, and I put it on the TV stations. They should never have bought this information and put it out. There was no news value to any of this. All right, and it was, as a matter of journalistic ethics, it was terrible. Nevertheless, the response has been terrible too. And there's no way that the police should have gone in and broken into a reporter's house, and it sets a terrible precedent. And as I say, what I worry about is not only this instance, but the chilling effect it can have on confidential sources, both on the national and the local level.
And just quickly,
and
Tim, with this case and Julian Assange being indicted for the on 17 accounts of violating the Espionage Act, this has never happened before. 30 seconds. What can people do to support press freedom?
Well, there's a lot of organizations from the California First Amendment Coalition, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press. There's a lot of organizations both locally and nationally that are working really hard to defend press freedoms in a very, very difficult time. And those organizations need your support. And, you know, so does the media in general. I mean, give money to KLW, support 48 Hills, subscribe to newspapers. You know, information may want to be free, but it isn't free. It doesn't. This stuff doesn't happen for free. And you know, this is a time when Trump has called us all enemies of the people. We need to support local news media.
Yes, thank you, Tim. Tim Redman is founder and journalist at 48 Hills and former editor and publisher of the San Francisco Bay Guardian. Thank you so much for all of your great work, and thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Calls Media Roundtable.